You're listening to WMRW LP Warren 95.1 FM, and we are here with Paul Gunter from Beyond Nuclear. I had met Paul at Into Eternity, which is the Nkulo Initiative. It's the hiding place. It's Finland's first permanent repository for nuclear waste, and actually the first repository for any nuclear waste in the world, as I understand it. So, Paul, how did you get involved with nuclear issues?
Well, Tim, I was in New Hampshire in 1975 when I heard about the announcement by Public Service Company of New Hampshire, a utility there, that they wanted to build two large Westinghouse pressurized water reactors in a sensitive saltwater estuary in Seabrook, New Hampshire. And we were aware that they and the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission had basically biased the whole licensing hearing process, which was really a situation where, you know, legal interveners from the environmental movement were really outgunned. And so we began a coalition of environmental activists there in New Hampshire and throughout New England to form a group called the Clamshell Alliance that would use the tradition of nonviolent civil disobedience and direct actions such as, you know, rallies, public educations, letters to the editor, a whole range of activities to mobilize and educate the public on the hazards of nuclear power. So that eventually led us to a series of site occupations at the Seabrook construction site beginning on August 1st, 1976. And I really became involved in the whole anti-nuclear issue back in 1976. And I was involved in this protracted nonviolent direct action campaign until 1990. But essentially, these actions at Seabrook coined the term no nukes and fostered the anti-nuclear power movement here in the United States.
So when you first started...
After Seabrook, I, you know, got some notoriety out of it and was hired in Washington, D.C., where I worked for 16 years with a group called Nuclear Information and Resource Service. In 2007, we founded this group, Beyond Nuclear, which is dedicated to public advocacy on the issues of nuclear power and nuclear weapons and the need to abandon both.
So when you first got involved in the nuclear issues, how did people react to you? I mean, were they pro-nuclear? Were people not really educated on the whole idea of nuclear power at that point in time? Or what was the feel back in 76?
Well, you know, in 1975, the nuclear industry and its proponents were basically saying that nuclear power was too cheap to meter, and that the, you know, that the peaceful atom had a role in the energy production. But, you know, as it turns out, we basically watched all these myths melt down. The public, you know, had real no examples other than a few near misses like the Browns Ferry fire in 1975 down in Alabama, where a fire at a nuclear power plant there almost resulted in a catastrophic nuclear accident. I think that we began to see and expose the myths of nuclear power that were being marketed to the public, that nuclear power was safe, clean, and abundant, and cheap. And in fact, over the years, as we began our activities and to educate ourselves and our neighbors, it was revealed to be dirty, dangerous, and expensive. And that certainly is the case today where, particularly post-Fukushima, now people realize that nuclear power is inherently dangerous, and the most expensive way that you could conceive of to boil water. And ultimately, you know, electricity is but a fleeting byproduct of nuclear power. In fact, the legacy is this timeless liability of nuclear waste, where, you know, generations will have all the liability of the toxic hazard without one watt of benefit of the you know, these nuclear power stations.
Well, and that's what I found with Into Eternity, which was very, it sort of struck me, I guess I was awestruck, just the whole concept of trying to store a byproduct or waste product that lasts for 100,000 years or so, and how do you deal with the whole issue, which Finland is the only country in the world that is actually doing something about it, am I correct?
Well, Finland is right now, along with Sweden, you know, they've started this, an actual, you know, project to dig a hole in the ground, in granite, you know, as deep as 500 to 900 meters deep, where they will then look to sequester nuclear waste, basically the irradiated nuclear fuel from their four nuclear power plants deep underground in the granite. But, you know, the problem is that, and what the movie Into Eternity addresses is that this is an unparalleled experimentation where, you know, nothing that human hands have ever constructed will measure up to the time needed to sequester this biological hazard. I mean, even the pyramids are only 5,000 years old, but imagine if they had been filled with nuclear waste. We're talking about an engineering project that needs, you know, really, I think, on the more on the order of a million years, according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. That's the time that they were looking at for sequestering and regulating, if you can imagine, the biological hazard from nuclear waste here in the United States. So, you know, we're talking about engineering something over geological spans of time that has this biological hazard. And, you know, clearly, you know, you start talking about issues of whether you want, you know, humankind to know about the hazard that's buried, or if you want to try to erase the hazard from human memory. And that you know, that's the struggle. You know, do we pass this toxic legacy on knowingly to countless generations, or do we engineer it so that they'll never know that it was buried, and you know, only to be discovered perhaps by the migration of radioactivity through groundwater, or you know, in some geological event, which you know, I think these are all testament to the fact that nuclear power really is, it's really irresponsible to be generating a toxic hazard which has this legacy that it will outlive any benefit. I mean, these are questions of morality, mm-hmm. as well as they are questions about technological you know, accomplishment or defeat.
I mean, exactly. I mean, the amount of years that it's going to be around after its useful life is pretty insane, and I don't think most people can even fathom how long that really is. As far as the human race, we haven't been around that long. And if you're talking nuclear waste, that's something that's going to be around for a very, very long time. And how do you make it safe? How does the United States at this present time deal with its nuclear waste?
Well, here in the United States, of course, you know, since the first cupful of nuclear waste was generated at Stagg Field at, you know, the University of Chicago back in on December 2nd, 1942, when the first criticality was initiated by Dr. Enrico Fermi as part of, you know, building the first atomic bombs, that we don't know what to do with that first cupful. We now have a mountain of nuclear waste more than 70 years high that has defied both our technological management and our just the whole political conundrum that it raises. So right now, all of the nuclear waste that's generated at reactors like Vermont Yankee is stored on site, and in most, particularly in the case of Vermont Yankee, which is one of these General Electric Mark I boiling water reactors, a Fukushima design reactor. All of the nuclear waste is being stored in a rooftop pool that sits 6 to 10 stories up in the reactor building. So it's basically the bottom of the pool is 60 feet above grade, and the pool surface is 100 feet. And in that are hundreds of tons of nuclear waste, this irradiated nuclear fuel, which is both thermally hot and extremely radioactive and must be constantly covered and shielded underwater in order to cool it. And this is a very precarious position, we feel, particularly with the fact that there's no place for this nuclear waste to go. And, there have been efforts to politically solve the nuclear waste issue by the Nuclear Waste Policy Act of 1982 was established by Congress to create two geological repositories, one in the western United States, and the second repository was to be in the eastern United States. And in the west, they were looking at Texas, Nevada, and Washington State, and in the eastern states, they were looking at granite rock bodies in Minnesota, New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine. There were 16 sites in 12 states that they began to characterize. But by 1987, they realized that there was no public confidence and certainly no public will to turn our heritage into national sacrifice areas for these nuclear waste repositories. And so the Congress revisited the Nuclear Waste Policy Act and amended it in 1987 to abandon the search for a geological repository except in one state. That was Nevada, at Yucca Mountain, Nevada. So it immediately went from a scientific study to a political mugging of the state of Nevada, and at that point, all of the research was basically conducted on a site that we already knew in the Nevada to be a seismologically active area surrounded by volcanoes. The Lathrop Well cinder cones were some of the youngest volcanoes in the United States, in North America. So it went immediately to being a completely unscientific process, where if it were a scientific process, you would actually be looking for the best of some candidates. But certainly by 2010, this became really untenable. And Congress thought would be a pushover to politically mug the state of Nevada and its two senators, it became clear that it was not going to go anywhere. This was not a technologically sound site. So they abandoned the search in Nevada in 2010. President Obama zeroed out the budget in the Department of Energy, and in 2011, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission suspended the licensing proceedings. So essentially, we're back to square one now. In August of 2011, the Sandia National Lab did a study that then basically recommended that the high-level nuclear waste repository search begin again. This time, they were recommending that the first repository be sited in Granite. So it would appear that when this search renews, and it will take an act of Congress, another amendment of the Nuclear Waste Policy Act, that it will begin by characterizing large granite crystalline rock rock bodies to put this repository in. So certainly that puts Vermont, Maine, New Hampshire, Minnesota, North Carolina, Virginia, it puts those 12 states back up at the top of the list.
Interesting. I'm sure people in Vermont are going to love that one. But, you know, unfortunately, this is something that the whole country we've done. And granted, a lot of us are not into nuclear power, but it's a problem that we have to deal with. And basically, it is going to be up to one of these states or several to take the responsibility of dealing with the waste. But my problem is, I mean, even if you're going to put it in Granite, there's still the water table. And I just don't see how they're going to get around with not destroying the water with the nuclear waste. It doesn't make sense to me. It's almost like there is not a safe place to put this stuff.
Well, that's precisely our concern. In fact, the first and most responsible step in managing this conundrum is to stop making more of this nuclear waste. In fact, I think that what we need to realize is that nuclear power plants like Vermont Yankee should first and foremost be looked at as nuclear waste factories, not electricity generators, because the electricity, again, is a fleeting byproduct, and the nuclear waste is really what is left behind. And you're right, anywhere that this nuclear waste goes, it's going to be a significant threat to future generations and the resources, vital resources such as water, where I think that people should realize that first and foremost that when you put 70,000 metric tons of nuclear waste in a granite rock body, that nuclear waste then heats up that rock body and will set up convection currents that will actually draw water into, you know, through fissures into the repository area, heat it up, and then, you know, generate steam even. And over periods of time, you know, I think that one of our big concerns is that you could actually see water drawn into these repositories, generated into steam, and then you have the potential for these, you know, potentially, you know, steam explosions or radioactive steam escaping from at repository depths to the surface. There's also the whole issue about the uncertainty around seismological activity over geological spans of time. There's really no way to accurately predict how the Earth is going to behave over the next 100,000, 500,000 million years. And I think that, again, it all comes back to this basic fundamental problem that, you know, you and I would not be allowed to build a house without a waste disposal permit and plan and how to proceed to deal with our waste. But an entire toxic industry has been allowed to commercialize and to go forward without any idea of what it's going to do with this waste except generate it and then pass that liability on to future generations for somebody else to take care of or to be sacrificed by. So, again, you know, this is much more than just a technological conundrum. I think these are fundamental moral issues about how we will or will not be good stewards to this planet and to generations to follow.
Well, my grandfather did a paper on nuclear energy in 1955, and one of the biggest problems that he was seeing was dealing with the waste, dealing with the wastewater, and basically how volatile the whole reaction process is. And so, you know, his main question is, you know, the viability of this as an energy source is pretty much crazy. And he was a Republican. He believed in, you know, science and looking at it, but he looked at the whole nuclear issue and at that point just didn't see that it was a viable energy source due to dealing with the waste. How did the nuclear industry get away with not having a plan? Or did they like say, oh, we have a plan and we're dealing with this, therefore the commission let them go? Or they just, to me, it seems like there never has been a plan.
Well, there's always been a scheme, but never a scientifically proven plan or management strategy.
Yeah.
The nuclear industry and the U.S. government simply proceeded with the notion that, you know, someday, somehow, somewhere, somebody will come up with some way of dealing with nuclear waste. That remains to be the case. Currently, what we're faced with, you know, for nuclear power plants like Vermont Yankee down there in southeastern Vermont, the whole nuclear waste issue for the license renewal of Vermont Yankee was not allowed to even be addressed in the public hearings on whether or not Vermont Yankee should be given a 20-year license extension, which, by the way, expires on March 21st, 2012. And they basically, through the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission rulemaking process, basically laid down a rule that said, it's called the Nuclear Waste Confidence Decision, ironically, that they have confidence that someday a plan will materialize and that in the meantime the nuclear power plants are allowed to generate it without any idea and with great uncertainty as to what it's gonna, where it's going to go, other than to continue to build up there in Vermont Yankee and you know, pose a biological hazard. You know, it's been basically a hot potato that's been passed from one generation to the next, and unfortunately, that appears to be what they plan to do with it, unless the state of Vermont puts its foot down and says that, you know, this is no longer in the public good to be generating nuclear waste without any responsible management plan, and simply, you know, refuse to allow the plant to continue to generate nuclear waste. I think that, again, this is the most and only responsible step, and then we have to look at what's there and then how to safely manage. And it's really going to be a containment management strategy, not any kind of permanent repository. I don't really believe that anything that can last as a toxic hazard for hundreds of thousands of years can be logically addressed with any idea that you have a permanent strategy. You know, this is really going to be something akin to Russian dolls, where you'll have probably a containment within a containment within a containment within another containment over periods of time. And I think that, again, the first and foremost step, though, is to stop generating nuclear waste. And then what that means is to shut these nuclear power plants down.
Okay, which basically goes to, we have a president that wants two new reactors built. Do you think that those reactors have a chance of getting built? I mean, it sounds like it's going to happen, but do you think that people in the United States are going to stand for it and let it happen? Because, I mean, we're going down the road again, just creating more waste and, again, not dealing with the problem that's at hand. Do you think the president will go ahead.
I think the Obama administration has fallen to the political and financial prowess of the nuclear industry. I mean, the nuclear industry, you know, they have a lot of money that they can fund both sides of the aisle, and that's certainly been the case with the Obama administration. And in the case of the two nuclear power plants that are licensed in Georgia, Vogtle 3 and 4, you know, what they demonstrate is the only way that you can build a nuclear power plant in the United States is, first of all, have it subsidized completely by the U.S. federal taxpayer through federal loan guarantees, and we're talking on the order probably of $15 billion per unit starting cost. And again, this is lowball. And then the financing charges for those federal loans are, in the case of Georgia, being fronted by the ratepayer through construction work in progress charges, through add-ons onto their utility bills before they even get 1 watt of electricity from these plants. So nuclear power really represents, you know, the only way it's going to be built is, you know, socializing all of the costs, where the nuclear industry, recognizing its own threat of financial meltdown, requires that the U.S. taxpayer and the ratepayer be saddled with all of the financial risk. Needless to say, though, that the risk is there, and even the U.S. Congressional Budget Office has recognized that there is greater than a 50% chance of default on these nuclear power plant projects, just because there is so much uncertainty in terms of how much construction will eventually cost, and there is demonstrated history that you cannot predict how long it's going to take to build one of these things. I mean, the last one that was really licensed in the United States took 25 years to build, at the Watts Bar Nuclear Power Plant in Tennessee. Since then, the nuclear industry has lost its vendors, and there, you know, is really not a stable infrastructure for even building new nuclear power plants now. And in fact, what it represents is not energy independence, but we wind up being bound in a nuclear fuel chain that links us to political regimes like the Congo or in Nigeria, where, you know, the people, the indigenous peoples of the world, are basically, again, in these uranium mining areas, they're largely indigenous people that are then, you know, the uranium is extracted, but these uranium mine tailings are left behind, again, as the first evidence of this irresponsible waste management. You know, we've still got mine tailings on the surface in New Mexico that have been left on Navajo lands as a toxic legacy. So at every link in this nuclear chain, there is this this concern that nuclear power is anti-democratic, it is an environmental hazard, and it represents a growing risk to public health and safety.
Well, and I feel even people that are aware of the nuclear issue and study it, I still don't think that any of us can really fathom the amount of subsidizing that goes on with the nuclear industry, how the waste problem is something that's never been dealt with, and I probably feel in my lifetime it's still not going to be dealt with because it's something that hasn't been dealt with from the get-go. I can't see there being any change in it. And it is a constant thing, going to different countries, leaving the waste from the start, even before it gets into the nuclear reactors. And it's just, I don't know, it's a sad thing to watch. And we all sit by and basically do nothing, except we're talking to Paul Gunter, who's part of Beyond Nuclear, and they're based out of Tacoma Park, Maryland, and they are an organization that is trying to do something about this. So is your specialty nuclear reactor oversight?
I've been involved in the nuclear issue as a community organizer, an environmental activist, and I come to this as a with a lay understanding of nuclear power after 37 years of involvement.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, however, the other piece that people should realize is that uranium is the currency of a coin whose flip side is nuclear power and nuclear weapons. Right now, there's a considerable amount of saber-rattling around the development of nuclear power in countries like Iran, where they are laying claim, as other countries, that their intent is only to build a peaceful atom, a nuclear power plant. But in fact, what is in fact the issue is that the easiest way to build a nuclear bomb is to put a nuclear power infrastructure around it. So in the enrichment of uranium for nuclear fuel grade is 3 to 5% uranium-235, but by simply diverting a small portion of that enrichment cycle, you can clandestinely enrich to bomb grade materials up to 90% uranium-235, and as a result, the issue is that countries like North Korea, who were originally signatories to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, they were allowed to build a nuclear infrastructure, and then they were, once they had nuclear bomb materials, they simply ignored this handshake agreement and proceeded with their nuclear weapons program. If we're really going to deal with the issue of global warming, and if the claim is true that nuclear power is a carbon-free pathway to addressing climate change, climate change has to be addressed on a global level, and as such, the transfer of civilian nuclear technology and the spread of nuclear materials all around the world, basically puts us in a situation where there is this proliferation of nuclear weapons. And to go from nuclear, from global warming to nuclear winter, from a nuclear war, does not represent a viable solution. So what we need to be doing is looking to renewable energy policy for a 21st century that is carbon-free and nuclear-free, using these renewable energy resources like wind and solar, coupled with energy efficiency and conservation, so that we abandon this whole extraction technology that gives us both carbon and global warming and uranium and the potential for nuclear winter from nuclear war. So you know, we need to break this fuel chain cycle and basically begin to harvest the renewable energy that comes to us every day through the sun and through the wind.
Yeah, the whole proliferation problem, I don't see a way around that, I guess, because being the United States and the way that we are, I mean, we threaten everyone not to do it, but yet we are one of the biggest supporters of nuclear arms, using depleted uranium, et cetera, et cetera. And it's like we try to tell other countries that they shouldn't be doing this. But yet when they do the nuclear power issue, which is always going to go to weapons, I mean, there's no way around it, regardless of what someone says. That's got to be in the back of their mind, because the nuclear warhead is the ultimate in defense / offense. And I don't see how we can change that, I guess, unless the United States decides to back off and get rid of its weapons, which they always threaten, but they never do. I mean, how do you think that we can deal with this proliferation issue as the United States?
Well, the proliferation issue of nuclear weapons, again, is a conundrum as mind-boggling as nuclear waste.
Yep.
You know, the issue is that we really need a new paradigm. We need a new way of thinking that abandons both the generation of nuclear waste and ultimately how that can be used for extracting plutonium for nuclear weapons and you know, the enrichment of uranium for nuclear bombs. I don't know that we have a choice, though, Tim. If we continue on the current course of nuclear weapons development, and not only in terms of vertical proliferation, which is the number of nuclear weapons in any particular country like the United States or Russia, mm-hmm. but the whole idea of horizontal proliferation, where then we see the development of more and more possessors of nuclear weapons, where then you begin also to have a vertical arms race, such as between India and Pakistan. You know, if there is a nuclear war that breaks out between a regional conflict like India or Pakistan, even that will have global consequences. We've seen scientific studies where even the exchange of 100 nuclear weapons between, say, India and Pakistan was the particular study, it will create, in that exchange, there'll be such a firestorm from burning cities and nuclear weapons detonations that it will loft enough smoke into the atmosphere to basically then filter out the sun's rays, and we'll see the collapse of agricultural systems all around the world just from a regional conflict. You know, we don't have a choice to really stand idly by, or more egregiously, to actively support the proliferation of nuclear materials through this the spread of nuclear technology. You know, this is a responsibility that, you know, with the knowledge of this threat, we have to take action. We have to be responsible for what our current generation is fostering. So again, it really comes down locally to act in a responsible fashion, and so we would say that, you know, people there in Vermont need to take a stand, and right now your stand is to make sure that the Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant is shut down, and to stop the nuclear waste generation and to stem the generation of nuclear materials that can be turned into nuclear weapons.
Right. I mean, basically, people, with the first basic step of demonstrating, getting people out in the public eye and being seen, which it's hard to get people organized, and getting them the understanding that if you start to gather in mass, people start to pay attention, where a lot of people go, okay, I don't like nuclear, but yet they don't want to drive down to Montpelier or wherever to demonstrate the issue, you know, to put it in the forefront of people's eyes. I mean, basically, at this point, everyone is well aware of it, but still we have mixed ideas on Vermont Yankee, because you have people that are saying, well, it's 30% of our energy supply and we can't get rid of it and we don't have alternatives and it's safe and all that stuff, which I have trouble with the argument of safe when you don't know how to get rid of the waste. And they're still touting Yucca Mountain as a sanctuary for the waste, which is now, as far as I know, it's a no-go, you know. So again, we're left with no place to put it. So in general in the United States, how would you say the shape of our reactors are? I mean, because a lot of them should be coming offline, I would think, soon, like Vermont Yankee. And
well, you know, as of March 22nd, if that nuclear power plant there in Vernon, Vermont is still operating, Vermonters will not get 1 watt of electricity from Vermont Yankee. I mean, this is a fact. That all of the Vermont utilities have let their contracts expire with Entergy.
Right.
So, you know, Vermont is not going to be getting any electricity from this aging and dangerous nuclear reactor. It will all be sold out of state. I think that's first of all, you know, a very important point for people to understand that you're generating nuclear waste and you're not getting even 1 watt of benefit. So all the more reason that people should be mobilizing to basically shut this plant down. But, you know, more particularly what we've seen now in the aftermath of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear accident, now just a little a year ago, these General Electric Mark I boiling water reactors are inherently dangerous. They're bad designs. They're 40 years old. They should be shut down because they have companies like Entergy have been milking them as cash cows, but putting little back in terms of maintenance and what should be, you know, if they should be doing anything, they should be building another containment over that reactor, because the one that's there, that General Electric Mark I, we've known since 1972 that if it is challenged by a severe accident, it is very likely to rupture and explode, just like we saw those three reactors explode on your television in the days following March 11, 2011. It's the same design, the same problems. You know, basically what happened there was a station blackout where they lost off-site power and they then lost on-site backup power, depleted the emergency batteries, and then the hydrogen gas was generated from the fuel damage and it found an ignition point and blew up. It doesn't take a tsunami or an earthquake. It can be something like a fire, or it could be a flood or a snowstorm that takes the off-site power out, and then, you know, some internal event like a fire or a human error that puts you in that same blackout situation, loss of cooling, and then fuel damage, hydrogen gas, and detonation, and you're on your way to meltdown. That's the scenario. There are a whole host of ways to get to that catastrophe, and the issue is that the containment is unreliable, and we've known that it's unreliable since 1972, and it's only gotten more unreliable as it's gotten older and as the system structures and components of this General Electric reactor have degraded and deteriorated over years and then neglected by a profit margin, you know, that puts profit margins ahead of safety margins. And this has been the case with Entergy. We've seen it where they, you know, allowed pipes carrying radioactive water under that plant to deteriorate because they're inaccessible. they're not maintained, they're not monitored, and so they go uncontained with the radioactive releases. And then the company like Entergy then tries to cover up these hidden hazards. They can no longer be trusted. And once they've lost that trustworthiness, it's all the more reason to say that we have to shut these power plants down.
Well, how trustworthy do you think the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is?
Your listeners only need know that the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission gave Vermont Yankee a 20-year license extension for a Fukushima design reactor only 10 days into the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear accident. I mean, they did not even skip a beat, Tim.
No,
they
not at all.
They were actively involved in promoting nuclear power by advancing the financial concerns of Entergy over the considerable questions and uncertainty. And, the fact that we just saw three GE reactors blow up by extending that power plant, by 20 years for operation, with the radiation clouds still, circulating around the Northern Hemisphere. The NRC at this point, cannot be trusted, because you need to realize that 90% of their budget, while it is allocated by Congress, is collected in fees, licensing fees, from companies like Entergy. And the continued operation of these dilapidated and unreliable designs, like the General Electric Mark I boiling water reactor. We've got 23 of these GE reactors around the country. If the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission were to say, hey, these are too dangerous to continue to operate, that would mean they'd have to cut about one quarter of their operating budget or raise the operating licensing fees to the rest of the industry. And, right now they're a captured regulator. And, again, it presents part of the problem that, we've got to reclaim the priority and the mandate for public health and safety and our environment over the emolument of a few men in these corporate CEO positions that hold sway politically and or even over the regulator. NRC at this point, we believe, means no regulatory control, and I really see that is best exemplified by the fact that the NRC has ignored such things as these leaks coming out of the Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant.
Right. It's like it's nothing to worry about is what we keep hearing up here. But, I mean, why is it that states really have no choice in this matter? I mean, granted, we're not experts, et cetera, but it's like we're not allowed to say we do not want this business in our state. I mean, what gives the Nuclear Regulatory Commission the authority to say, like, what a business can do?
Right now, what we have is a situation where the state of Vermont, through its legislative process, has enacted duly promulgated law to say that it is no longer in the public interest to allow Vermont Yankee to operate beyond its 40-year license period. And that law was passed, and it was clearly established that issues like no place for the nuclear waste to go, the untrustworthiness of companies like Entergy to put public safety and health ahead of their own production agenda, these are fundamental issues that have undermined the credibility and the trustworthiness of Entergy and the continued operation of Vermont Yankee. And the state decided, and now again in the aftermath of Fukushima, the NRC said that they were going to give the license, the relicense anyways. So we have now a contest between the federal preemption of duly promulgated state law and the right of a state for self-determination of its own energy policy and to protect the public good. So now that we have a situation where the state has appealed the Entergy suing them to overrule the state law, and the federal effort to preempt the state law, all this is going to court. But in the meantime, there is the court of public opinion, which we believe has been, a very vital and lively place for social change in American history. When Vermonters, back during, before the Civil War, as part of, they violated the Slave Act, which, basically said that if you harbor slaves that are fleeing from the South, that you're in violation of federal law. Vermonters and New Englanders, they did not believe in slavery, and so they did harbor people on their way out of slavery in the South. They supported things like women's suffragette movement to give women the vote. There were the Civil Rights Act, that basically opened the South to integration and put down segregation. All these took a major change in public consciousness and major changes in the court of public opinion. And we believe that this is another example, another time for people to take a stand and to take a stand for your own self-determination for energy policy there in the state of Vermont and become a precedent for self-determination for a renewable energy policy in the United States and around the world.
Basically get vocal. So I guess one thing I'm always wondering, and I didn't really study it much when it happened, but Maine Yankee was taken offline a while ago. Do you know anything about Maine Yankee, like how they were able to do that? Because to me, I don't see why we're having such a problem getting Vermont Yankee offline. I mean, it's gone past its expiration date, basically. And it is becoming unsafe the longer it stays around. But Maine didn't seem to have a problem getting rid of Maine Yankee. And as far as their power usage, and they don't seem to have a problem getting power either, which puzzles me. And then we have Green Mountain Power in this state. It's like, okay, they're not going to buy from Vermont Yankee, but they have a contract, I believe, with Seabrook. So they're still using nuclear power. It's just coming from somewhere else, trying to appease Vermonters, which is a puzzling situation to me. But do you know anything about the shutdown of Maine Yankee?
Well, I think that, in the example of the shutdown of Maine Yankee in Wiscasset, Maine, and the closure of Yankee Row in Western Massachusetts, these were financial decisions that the power companies made. In this case, Maine Yankee was singularly the only nuclear power plant that Central Maine Power operated. In the case of Yankee Row, it was, a small utility saddled with the cost of these exorbitantly expensive to maintain nuclear power plants. In this case, so they made decisions that it was time to get out of nuclear power when they were faced with costly large ticket items like degraded steam generators in Maine Yankee. There were lots of issues with lack of compliance with fire protection. In the case of Yankee Row, they had cracks that were growing in the reactor pressure vessel that put them in a position of where they were going to have to maybe take out one of the largest components and replace it in the Yankee Row nuclear power plant. So they made financial decisions that closed those plants down. The case with Entergy and Vermont Yankee, though, is that Entergy operates nuclear power plants in New York and Vermont and Massachusetts and Michigan. It's several states, Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, where, you know, they can basically run these plants into the ground and, you know, with a and milk them for all they're worth. They also take advantage of rotating teams, maintenance teams that go around the country. So, you know, they're managing and through cost cutting to continue to milk these reactors, despite the fact that they're bad designs, they're old designs, and they're deteriorating. But our concern is they are their first agenda is to get profits out of these plants. And what we've seen with fires and collapsing cooling towers and broken pipes is that they're allowing the infrastructure in plants like Vermont Yankee to break down. And, you know, they've adopted policies like leak first, fix later, which does not put the public health and safety in the forefront. And that's why we, you know, we're concerned, again, that, you know, companies that are, you know, headquartered in New Orleans are making decisions on Vermonters' lives and livelihood and environment that is not in your best interest. It's not in your public good.
Exactly. Well, Paul, I could go on forever because this is very enlightening, but we're just about out of time. So I guess if you could give us a little closing words on nuclear energy and the state of Vermont or the nation or the world, actually, because it's all connected. And that's the one thing with nuclear power. Wherever you are, you're connected to the rest of the world, which I think some people can't really fathom that concept for some reason. So final words.
What we've realized since 1972, when Dr. Stephen Anauer, who was then with the Atomic Energy Commission, said that the Atomic Energy Commission should adopt the policy to discourage the further use of the General Electric Mark I boiling water reactor like Vermont Yankee. He was told by his boss, then Joseph Hendry, you know, Steve, I don't necessarily disagree with you. You've got some good points. But if we follow through on this, it could very well mean the end of nuclear power. The Atomic Energy Commission and its successor, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, went on to license 16 more General Electric Mark I boiling water reactors like the Fukushima design there at Vernon, Vermont. Clearly, the policy has been to promote these dangerous, dirty, and expensive nuclear reactors. And now is the time for Vermonters to set the precedent that you can self-determine your energy policy in the interest of the public good, and not only for this generation, but for future generations. And we support you, we encourage you, and we will work with you to shut down the Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant.
Well, thank you very much, Paul. It's always good to know that there's someone to our back. And if anybody wants more information, it's beyondnuclear.org, and I figure you can see what they are about. Well, thank you very, very much, Paul. Greatly appreciated for
thank
the work
you
that you've done and what you're doing. And I hope to talk to you again.
Thanks. No nukes.
Right, no nukes. Have a good day now.